Welcome to Veterans Voices UK, the podcast dedicated to capturing and sharing the stories of those who served, ensuring their experiences, their sacrifices and resilience are never forgotten. Through these conversations, we bring you face to face with history, honouring our veterans and the remarkable lives they led. This special episode marks a historic moment, the 80th anniversary of VE Day. A moment when we, as a nation, come together to pause, to reflect and remember, not just the end of the war in Europe, but the extraordinary men and women whose courage and sacrifice made that victory possible. It is vital that we keep the veterans at the heart of our thoughts and our remembrance. Those who lived through it, those who fought for it, and for many, those who paid the ultimate price. Their voices must be heard, their stories must be remembered, and their service must be honoured, now more than ever. On this anniversary, we take a step back to truly understand what it meant to be there, to feel the weight of those final days of the war, and to experience the hope that followed. Today's episode is a one-off special, bringing together several remarkable veterans I had the privilege of meeting while researching for my book, We Will Remember, World War II Veterans. These are personal accounts of VE Day, of the triumph, the uncertainty, and the quiet sacrifices that often go unnoticed. Stories remind us that behind every flag that is waved and every bell that is rung, there were real lives and real people, each with their own journey. So as we gather for the 80th anniversary as a nation, we must pause and listen, but above all, we must remember and never forget. But before we begin, I just want to mention that the words you hear from the veterans are voiceovers based on original recordings I made during the research for my book. Such recordings were just informal interviews, just casual conversations to capture thoughts, stories and memoirs. But I've used these recordings with the full consent of the veterans, as I'm sure you'll agree, their stories are far too important to not share. During my research, I had the privilege of spending time with Ernest Triner, a man whose memories of the final months of the war were as vivid and as clear as ever, even though he sat there in his late 90s. He spoke about crossing the Rhine with the 51st Highland Division, the intense fighting that followed, and a moment of real danger when his battalion headquarters was overrun, leaving him as a prisoner of war for several hours. But his journey into the front line had its own twists. Ernest's conscription into the army was deferred so he could complete his teacher training, but he then went on to serve as a regimental signaller with the 5th Battalion of the Seaforth Highlanders. Before that, he spent time with a parachute regiment during the Battle of the Bulge, but they were experiences that clearly left a deep impression on him. So here's Ernest's story as he shared it with me a couple of years ago.
The Dutch border was close by, and a few days later our unit move some distance north into Holland. Two of us were billeted with a couple who put us up in a very comfortable bedroom. He was an engine driver, which was not very healthy, as he had been strafed by Allied aircraft. What a joy it was. After sleeping rough for weeks, I often regret not noting their names and details to thank them for their hospitality. One afternoon, the town was bedecked with flags, and we witnessed the arrival of Prince Bernhard to join the locals in their celebrations of liberty, a unique occasion and long remembered. Then the rumor filtered through that the war was nearly over and we had finished. 2 days later, that situation was dashed, and We were ordered to be prepared to move at any time. The retreating Germans were blowing every bridge and culvert to delay our advance, and it was our role to prevent this and get behind them. So we moved back into Germany. We forced marched through the night, trying to get behind the German lines. As we marched, we came across a German car with four soldiers in, a few shots, and they soon came out. Then into the outskirts, Bremerhaven. We were then moved to take the small town of Bremervoorde, to the east, following some shell fire. I remember having to race to a narrow river and crossing a special bridge thrown over by one of the specialist tanks. We approached the bridge by a shallow ditch, and one of my lasting memories was having to stride over the dead body of one of our men. He must have surely been the last man of the division to lay down his life, because the fighting was over. The very next day, we got ordered to do nothing unless attacked. I think it was 6th May, 1945. We then moved up to Cuxhaven to take the surrender. As we approached the town, the German Marines marched out 4 abreast, all spick and span, to surrender. The Marines were immaculate, with jag boots polished and uniforms perfect, probably to impress us. They saluted every officer, but I doubt if we were in the mood to be impressed.
That was Ernest's story, with a glimpse into the final dramatic weeks of the war through his own eyes. For him, as so many of his generation, VE Day was a moment of relief, reflection, and quiet remembrance. Another veteran I interviewed for the book was Donald Rose, who is now recognised as the oldest surviving veteran of World War II. Donald will celebrate his 111th birthday later this year. Donald's story reminds us that for many, VE Day was not an easy time. He'd served through the harsh campaigns of North Africa, Italy, and finally Northwest Europe. Then, as the war drew to a close, Donald was amongst the first soldiers to enter the concentration camp at Bergen-Belsen. Given all he had witnessed, understandably, Donald did not wish to say much about his time. In truth, I suspect for him, the passing of VE Day went almost unnoticed.
I never had to join up, but I did. There was a war on, and they needed men to fight. That's why I joined. I wanted to save this country from the fascists. That's the reason I joined the army. When I joined the army, this sergeant said to me, "I will show you some fighting. I'm going to show you an uppercut." So I hit him. Then this captain came shouting, "Stop, stop. You have killed him. Look at him lying there." He had his arms out, and this other sergeant said, "No, I don't think he is dead." I went to join the Queen's in Guildford. I did my basic training at Guildford in Stoughton Barracks. I was there for about 6 weeks. I remember a route march, and at the end of it, a sergeant major said to me, "You will make a good corporal one day." I said, "I don't want to be a corporal." I was very happy being one of the boys.
I asked Donald about his time during the North Africa campaign, but like so many of his generation, he did not wish to say much. But several times he said it was hard, and the sights he saw were terrible. In respect, I let Donald tell his own story, then recalled a briefing, or as Donald said, a lecture, from General Montgomery soon after the Battle of Tobruk in North Africa.
He said, "You are not here to run after women." That was a joke. There wasn't any. He said, "You are here to fight, and you will fight if you get your guts blown out and head blown off. You will fight." So I shouted out, "If I get my head blown off and my guts blown out, can I have 7 days of sick leave?" I remember shivering in the cold in Italy. I was like a block of ice. When I was in North Africa, there was no rain. We would get lightning storms, but no rain. Italy was so cold. I remember after arriving, an officer told me I was exceeding the speed limit. "You were doing 45. Slow down." I said, "Excuse me, sir, but if the motor in front of me is doing 90 miles, I do 90 miles, as you are not allowed to break convoy." He said, "Don't tell me a load of rubbish." When we got to our destination, he said, I am going to put this man on a charge for exceeding the speed limit. Someone said, have you seen the speedometer and what it says? It is in kilometers.
After fighting his way north through Italy in March 1945, Donald was in Germany when he was one of the first soldiers to reach the concentration camp at Bergen-Belsen.
I didn't enjoy Belsen, seeing all the people just skin and bones, skeletons were walking about. It was horrendous. As the war finished, I was still at Belsen where the concentration camp is. I was there for about a year or something like that.
Donald's experience reminds us that while VE Day brought celebrations for many, for others, the scars of war were still too fresh. His quiet dignity speaks volumes about the true cost of conflict and the resilience of those who live through it. The final veteran we'll hear from is Jack Dickinson. Like so many of his generation, Jack will turn 100 years old later this year. Another powerful reminder of why it is so important to capture and share their stories while we can. I can still picture sitting with Jack as he talked about his life of growing up in a proud mining village and his family that originated from the northeast of England. He spoke fondly, remembering his father and uncles who served in the Great War, and just as clearly recalled the sight and sound of German bombers overhead during the Second World War. Then, at 18 years old, Jack was called up and his papers arrived, soon followed by his medical. He was ready to join the army, but as Jack now tells us, fate had a very different path in mind.
I was conscripted into the forces. It was either joining up or going down the pit. But as my dad said, one down, the pit is enough. There were a lot of accidents down the pit in those days. My dad had scars all over him. I was 18 and got a letter for a medical at Mansfield in an old chapel which had been made into a medical and recruiting place. The RAF bloke said we would like you in the RAF, but you have got a wonky eye and I don't think we want any more ground staff. So I went to the army bloke. He said, yes, you are fine for the army. We will let you know more. I went home expecting to join the army. Then I got a letter saying I was in the RAF. I did my square bashing course. Then after a bit, I went to do a flight mechanics course. So I was going to be ground crew, not flying. I enjoyed the course. Every Saturday night we went to Weston-super-Mare, where I met a few girls. I passed the course and then went on my first 7 days of leave in my RAF uniform, feeling very proud. After my leave, I went back to Locking. Then, on the following morning's parade, I was told you're in the army, as from today, so get your kit together as you move out tomorrow. It was not just me. It was a load of us. We went to Liverpool to swap our kit over. Then we were all posted to whichever branch of the army we were going to. I went to the tanks at 52 Training Regiment at Bovington. There were a lot of recruits there for driving and a lot of guardsmen. After Bovington, it was 14 days leave. Then I was on a boat to India. We arrived in Bombay. The ship was the SS Strathaden. As we arrived in Bombay, we have a free day, so we had to walk around then, found a swimming pool. We hired swimming stuff and went swimming. That was my first day in India. We then went to a transit camp about 50 miles from Bombay. Eventually, we were posted. I went to A squadron, but B and C squadron plus HQ squadron were in a different place. There was no one in A squadron. When I arrived, we were told they were still all in Burma. The place we slept in was terrible, very small, and four of us had to sleep in there. It had matting sides, a thatched roof, but no doors, no windows. They looked like they had been built quickly for us, but there were scorpions and snakes about. We also had kite hawks, that's what we were told they were, that sat in the trees. But as you walked from the cookhouse carrying your plate of food, the kite hawks would swoop down and steal your dinner. We never would tell anyone new arriving. They had to learn. They may have been kite hawks, but we knew them as shite hawks. After some time, the rest of the squadron arrived, and they made us up into tank crews. Then this railway wagon came in. On the back, all sheeted up, was our tanks. After they unloaded, we got into our crews. I had a corporal tank commander. The rest of the crew had just come out of being in action in Burma. I don't know what happened, but three or four lads from a squadron went to investigate some Japanese, and they were never seen again. I think there is a memorial in Burma for them. No one had any idea what happened to them. When the training was finished, we were waiting for a boat to pick us up to deploy. The other squadrons were loaded. We were all parked up waiting to go, ammunition loaded and everything. Then they cancelled it. It took a few days, then we learnt the Americans had dropped the bomb on Japan that morning as we were waiting to sail. The war stopped just like that. It was over. The Japs had packed it in. On VJ night, or a few days after, when we knew, we got a big can, about 5 gallons, and we got it filled with beer. There was nowhere to go, no electricity, just lamps to sit and write a letter home. It was a rough place.
Jack's story reminds us that the war did not end with VE Day. I doubt you even noticed it being in the Far East, and it would mean so very little to him. VE Day was far from the end of the war, which would rage on until the autumn, ending, as Jack told us, when he was about to sail and deploy. As we mark the 80th anniversary of VE Day, we do more than celebrate a historic victory. We honour the men and women who lived through it. Their memories remind us that behind every headline and every parade were real people. Young men and women who answered the call, often at great personal cost. We must keep in mind that this anniversary may also be the last great opportunity to gather and hear directly from those who served in the Second World War. Their voices are fewer now, but they're no less vital. Moving forward, it is our duty to listen and preserve these stories, and to keep their experiences alive for future generations. To all the veterans who served, those we heard from today, plus the many others we carry in our hearts, we will remember you, and we must make sure that others do too. Finally, if you'd like to read the full stories of the veterans featured in this episode, my book, We Will Remember, World War II Veterans, is now available online from the Great British Bookshop at www.thegreatbritishbookshop.co.uk. As this special episode draws to a close, thank you for being part of our community. We look forward to you joining us in the next episode. Until then, I'm Matt Lim, and this has been Veterans Voices UK.